Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The FT.
Welcome to World Weekly. I'm Ben Hall. On the show this week, we'll be looking at the prospects for peace in Syria as world powers gather in Switzerland in an attempt to find a diplomatic solution to the country's three-year civil war. The conflict has cost more than 130,000 lives and has drawn in regional powers who are fighting a vicious proxy sectarian war. The peace conference nearly fell apart before it had even started, when the United Nations invited Iran to take part, only to rescind the invitation 24 hours later. Joining me down the line from Cairo is Borzu Daragahi, the FT's Middle East correspondent, and with me in the studio is Rula Khalaf, the FT's foreign editor. Borzu, can I start with you? The negotiations have got underway in Montreux. What are your early impressions?
Well, I think it's very inconclusive as to what this conference is going to produce. I think many of the parties are there with different agendas, some there to move towards the removal of Bashar al-Assad, some there to, such as Syria, but also Lebanon, to solidify the presence of the Bashar al-Assad regime, and some just kind of hangers-on. You know, for example, Egypt was there, we're not quite sure why, and spent much of its time trying to hobnob with various officials that won't come to Cairo because of the political situation there.
Rula, do you detect any hope that there could be progress?
I don't think in the short term there can be progress, because today is essentially just a kind of show to say that, you know, the world cares about Syria and the world wants to find a solution. I think Syrians have been dismayed by the lack of attention and the lack of diplomacy on Syria. And so this is an attempt by Western governments, but also by supporters of the Syrian regime, to say everybody's trying. The problem, of course, is that the two sides who will sit down for the first time around a negotiating table, and that will be later this week, are there for completely different reasons. The opposition is there because they believe that the conference is based on a transition plan, that that's the agenda, is a transition plan, which would mean the end of Bashar al-Assad as the ruler of Syria. And the regime is there because this is a platform for them to express their own side of the story, which is that they're fighting terrorism. At this stage, at least, there is no conversions here of what the two sides are supposed to talk about. And we'll have to see, starting on Friday, whether the mere fact of putting them in the same room can bridge some of the differences. And I think nobody's expecting any breakthrough anytime soon.
And, of course, some of the parties fighting this war are not present at all. In other words, the jihadi groups, who seem to have no interest in any kind of ceasefire, let alone peace. So isn't it just futile to talk in Geneva?
I think that there's a recognition that, given that there's no military solution to this conflict, you have to start some kind of diplomatic process. You're right. It's not just that the armed groups aren't there, and the fact that the opposition people who are there don't really represent these armed groups. There's the absence of Iran is also problematic, because, yes, Russia can have some influence on the Assad regime, but I think a more important influence would be the Iranian influence, and it would be much better to have them at the conference than outside.
Borzu, it was interesting, wasn't it, that Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, invited Iran, even though Iran hadn't accepted the principle of the departure of Bashar al-Assad, the Syrian leader. Why do you think he did that?
I mean, I think that Ban Ki-moon sees Iran's participation in these talks as vital for their success. Listeners may recall the narrative of how Iran and its proxies managed to attempt to sabotage and contribute to the collapse of peace efforts between Palestinians and Israelis in the 90s. Iran may not be able to forge a peace or bring about peace in Syria, but it can certainly contribute to a continuation of the war. And as Rula said, you know, it's probably better to have all of the parties, all of the belligerent parties at the table than to alienate some, especially since not only is Iran contributing some of its own ground forces in the form of IRGC advisors and perhaps more to the conflict, it's also backing or at least encouraging the participation of both Hezbollah and the Iraqi Shia militias that are fighting alongside Bashar al-Assad's forces.
Rula, is there any sign that Iran is prepared to distance itself from Bashar al-Assad following the early rapprochement with the United States over Iran's nuclear ambitions? Is there any read across from the warming of relations on that front?
So far, none, I would say. I think that the nuclear talks are very much focused on that dossier and absolutely nothing else. In fact, the Americans have made clear that they don't want to talk about anything else. I think the Iranians have tried to broaden the talks, but I think the American attitude and generally the Western attitude is that if you do that, then you risk diluting the focus on the nuclear talks, and they don't want to sort of have any bargaining, you know, we'll do this on the nuclear side if you do that on Syria or on Lebanon. So I think the Iranian attitude has not changed when it comes to Syria. The way I see it is that the Iranians see a possible opportunity when the presidential elections take place. They're not really elections. I mean, it's usually just a referendum on Assad. But there are presidential elections scheduled for sometime in the spring, around June. And so I think they see that as potentially a way to find some kind of transition plan.
Bozo, you could understand why the Syrian opposition groups and the Saudis were deeply unhappy at the prospect of the Iranians taking part. But why would the Americans and the British and the French react so strongly if the Iranians are so crucial to any diplomatic breakthrough?
Well, it was mostly the Americans. I think that this has to do to a large extent with the strained relations between the Obama administration and the Saudis. The Saudis are upset. They're upset at the Obama administration's outreach to the Iran on the nuclear issue. They're upset that Iran seems to be getting a free hand in sending its proxies throughout the Levant. They're upset that the U.S. appeared on the verge of bombing Syria over its use of chemical weapons and then moved towards diplomacy at some point and left the advocates of an armed response somewhat out on a limb. Because of that, I think that the U.S. was sort of backed into a corner where it was forced to accede to Saudi demands on this issue. On the part of the Syrian opposition as well, they're very strained in their relations with the actual people on the ground fighting and trying to survive in Syria. If the Syrians were seen to be bucking on the issue of Iran's participation in these talks, I think the Syrian opposition was very worried that it would even further damage relations with their grassroots who are actually in the country. And I think that that contributed to the U.S. Not wanting to undermine the Syrian opposition by allowing Iran to participate in these talks. I would love to hear what Rula has to say about that.
I think that one of the most important elements of these negotiations, actually the most important element, is to be able to have the opposition and the regime in the same place and to begin negotiations. Everybody else is just there for a day and for speeches. So if Iran had been at the conference today, then it is likely that the opposition delegation would have withdrawn. And I think that was more important at the end of the day, is to have the opposition delegation, because without them, you essentially do not have any talks.
Let us assume that there is no breakthrough at this meeting in Geneva. What can the West do?
I think this conference is perhaps far too ambitious in what it's trying to do. It would have been much better to focus it simply on attempts to get a ceasefire, to get humanitarian aid in, which is what Syrians absolutely need at this time. I think by going for a political solution, which everyone knows is not within reach at this time, you might have actually complicated the more modest goals, which would be to find just some way of calming the situation on the ground, even for a limited period of time. But it's quite unusual in situations like this, where you've had 3 years of civil war, for there not to have been a single ceasefire. There hasn't been a single let up, not for one day.
Bozid, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that getting some sort of humanitarian aid, getting some sort of relief to the people in Syria, that they're suffering so much under this conflict that has ground on now for 3 years, would have probably been a more doable agenda for this this conference. But I also think that more likely than not, the West could have done a better job and still can do a better job of properly equipping those rebel groups that more or less reflect some of its values, and giving them the tools to surmount both the more extreme elements of the opposition and the regime. I think that's something the West could have done, and, you know, to many people who are sympathetic to the opposition cause, as the West says it is, there's somewhat a bafflement as to why they haven't put their chips on the table, just as the Iranians and the Russians and the Saudis and the Qataris have. I mean, the West has a huge stake in what happens in Syria. So some people ask, why not play the same hardball that those players are playing?
I suspect Western diplomats and analysts will be poring over this for years ahead and looking at all the mistakes that they've made over the years. My thanks to Borzu Daragahi in Cairo and to Rula Khalaf in London. That's it for this week. World Weekly is produced by Martin Staber. Till next week, goodbye.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.